Your Honor, Chief Justice Greenhill, at the outset, for clarification purposes, the brief which is labeled a reply to our application for writ of error, the application by Era Wesson, was filed and hand-delivered to me on October the 8th, just a few days ago. I didn't have an opportunity to prepare a reply, so my motion to strike it has been filed. I did have time to prepare that, obviously, and it's an alternative motion, although it doesn't say so. It's labeled to at least allow me an opportunity to reply to what he, at this 11th
time. How much time would you like?
About it. Your Honor, 10 days.
I think the court would agree that's reasonable. And that'd be more help to the court than striking briefs.
May it please the court, my name is Lou Schofield. I'm an attorney from Beaumont, Texas, with the law firm of Mahaffey, Weber, Keith, and Gonsolin. I'm here representing Era Wesson individually and as independent executrix of the estate of her husband, Doyle Thomas Wesson. This is a suit for damages due to a failure to procure mortgage cancellation insurance, which would have discharged the indebtedness on a home loan made by Jefferson Savings and Loan Association. At the trial court, the suit was filed in 1977. It went on for a number of years through discovery process, and as the court will note when it reviews the transcript, voluminous motions and then motions on motions until finally it came to a head with motions for summary judgment being filed by both Era Wesson and Jefferson Savings and Loan Association. The trial court granted summary judgment first as to liability in favor of Era Wesson, and then after the parties agreed and stipulated as to the amount and measure of damages, final judgment was entered subsequent to that. The matter was appealed by Jefferson Savings and Loan, and the appellate court, the Court of Civil Appeals at Beaumont, initially affirmed the granting of the summary judgment, citing as authority this court's opinion in City of Fort Worth versus Pippin and Watkins versus Valley Fidelity, a Tennessee appellate court case. Then, on motion for rehearing, it withdrew that first opinion and substituted instead a second opinion, which is attached to our application for writ of error as Appendix B, which did not contradict or in any way set aside its findings with reference to the law in its first opinion, but on the contrary, simply created what it deemed to be a fact question and said, therefore, summary judgment was not appropriate and reversed and remanded the case for trial. We filed our application for writ of error on basically three points, and that is, number one, the summary judgment in favor of Era Wesson at the trial court stage and the original affirmance by the Court of Civil Appeals was entirely proper. Number two, the fact question that was created by the Court of Civil Appeals is not a fact question relevant to this case. And number three, even if it were, it's been established against Jefferson Savings and Loan Association. Turning first to the basic contention, and that is that the summary judgment was proper. In order to understand that, the undisputed facts need to be pointed to. Number one, back in 1967 or 68, Jefferson Savings and Loan and the Wessons got together in order to get a home loan so they could buy a home. The loan was in the amount somewhat in excess of $20,000. Jefferson Savings and Loan required mortgage cancellation insurance. In the documents that are in the record, it merely states that mortgage cancellation insurance was required, but at no point says who was to acquire it. Then on the closing statement, which is referred to in the brief, there were certain charges set out at the closing, and among those was the estimated monthly installment, and included in the estimated monthly payment was an identified and identifiable amount of $19.95 for mortgage cancellation insurance. The matter was closed, the loan was made, the house was built, and for years the Wessons dutifully paid, and there's no indication that they were ever even late, but dutifully paid not only the loan to Jefferson Savings and Loan as the lender, but dutifully paid the amounts that Jefferson Savings and Loan demanded into the escrow account to discharge taxes and insurance expenses and things of that sort. At no time did Jefferson Savings and Loan ever acquire the insurance. At no time did Jefferson Savings and Loan ever advise the Wessons, notwithstanding these payments for the insurance over the years, that the insurance was not obtained. Instead, since insurance was not obtained and $19.95 extra was being paid into the escrow account, Jefferson Savings and Loan, on two different adjustments, neither in the amount of $19.95, tried to gin out the excess that was created in the escrow account and took that excess money and deposited it to their benefit to discharge some of the indebtedness. It was also to the Wesson's benefit, but deposited it to discharge some of the other indebtedness. quietly absorbing this excess that they had accumulated. Never once did they send any kind of notice to the Wessons that this was being done or why or where the 1995 was. As a matter of fact, the only thing that was ever sent to the Wessons under the record before us was a yearly statement, much like I'm sure that each of you have seen or that I see, what I usually use for my tax purposes to see how much interest I paid, a yearly statement, and referred to general code categories, and in that code category were expenditures every year except for the first for insurance. And those amounts varied over the years all the way up until Mr. Wesson's death. The Wessons believed that there was mortgage cancellation insurance on the house, which is supported in the summary judgment proof by affidavit by Mrs. Wesson, and the amount and measure of damages are agreed to, and it is our contention that this creates a complete cause of action. The cause of action initially arises out of the duty that is owed, and the duty that is owed arises out of the relationship between the parties. This is not a typical case involving a contract between two parties dealing equally with one another. This is a sophisticated savings and loan who prepared all of the instruments and all of the forms that were to be used in this transaction. Sophisticated savings and loan who, not only for the benefit of the Wessons, but for their own benefit in securing this transaction, required the insurance and who collected premiums for it and who controlled the account. And they were the people who therefore owed, under this court's decision in City of Fort Worth versus Tiffin, the fiduciary duty to either acquire the insurance or take steps to do so, or to advise that it was not acquired so Mr. Wesson could have done something to protect his wife from continued indebtedness in the event of his death. Although I didn't have an opportunity, as I stated at the beginning, to prepare a complete response to the most recently filed reply to our application for writ of error by Jefferson Savings and Loan, in it a case is cited. In it, a case is cited that I think exactly establishes my point as to the relationship between the parties. It is an 1887 Supreme Court case, Weinstein versus National Bank, which respondent cites as authority for the fact that it was the Wessons that should have found out that there wasn't any mortgage cancellation insurance and should have found out what happened to all their premium payments over the years. That case, the Weinstein case, involved a checking account where the person who owns the checking account controls the amount of money deposited into it and controls the amount of money that is written out of it. It was a suit by the person who owned the checking account against the bank because a forger had been forging checks, and the court understandably held that, that the person who owns the checking account has a duty to exercise reasonable diligence to discover the forgery himself. That is totally different than the case at hand. In the checking account case, in the Weinstein case, control of the account is by the depositor. In this case, it was Jefferson Savings and Loan which made demand for payment in X amount, including a mortgage cancellation insurance premium, and who completely controlled the disbursement, and who never advised the Wessons over the years that no insurance was being obtained with the premiums that they were dutifully paying. It is precisely that aspect of control, and it's precisely that aspect of absolute reliance upon the person running the escrow account, and incidentally, it's not a true escrow, as I understand this court's opinion in Tiffin, it's a depository relationship that gives rise to a fiduciary duty of loyalty and a duty of strict accountability to either properly apply the funds or advise as to excesses or advise, in this case, as to the failure to procure insurance, regardless of the reason. A duty was therefore owed, and a duty as between the parties that ran toward the Wessons and not from the Wessons toward Jefferson Savings and Loan. That duty was breached because insurance was not procured, no steps were taken to procure it by Jefferson, nor did they advise that it was not procured.
Counsel, was the extra $19.95 paid over the entire 8 years of the loan until the death of Mr. Wesson?
Justice Spears, for all we know, it was. It is absolutely undisputed that the $19.95 was being paid in that first year. But the record, and that it was identifiable, and that was what it was for. But the record then discloses not a $19.95 adjustment downward, but instead a $10 adjustment downward a year after the loan was consummated and payments were being made, and then a subsequent adjustment later of $9 more, approximately a year later, and then a few more years down the line, increases. In short, this escrow account, like every escrow account, was fluctuating in nature. The amounts that were being asked to be deposited in, again controlled by Jefferson, fluctuated over time. It's been our experience lately that those generally will increase because taxes increase and insurance premiums increase. But in this case, that is not necessarily true. And there was nothing to alert the Wessons that a $10 adjustment and a $9 adjustment, it's placed a year apart, had anything to do with mortgage cancellation insurance. So I submit that for sure it was being paid that first year. And it must have been being paid for the rest of the time. And that is all that should be required, because it would be impossible for any litigant under these circumstances to then establish, when the other party has complete control of the account, that of this commingled amount that they were commingling, that this discrete amount involved mortgage cancellation insurance. In order to discern that, you have to look at the onset of the transaction. We had an identified and identifiable amount of $19.95 that was included, specific elements, and the only thing we can assume is that people would carry those elements, whether it be the insurance, school taxes, city taxes, those elements would be carried through the entirety of the loan, regardless of varying amounts of each element. The party, again, controlling those quantities or those amounts of money was Jefferson Savings and Loan, and that's all that we can consider is that they were paid. Now, throughout the appellate process in this case, Jefferson Savings and Loan has repeatedly contended that the Wessons were informed, or at least were put on notice to inquire, as to the status of their mortgage cancellation insurance, the premium. They say that this was done by the fact of these yearly statements that were given. At this point, it ought to be put at rest. It has been repeatedly pointed out that that precise point has been ruled against and deemed admitted by the trial court with regard to requests for admissions at that stage. The specific inquiry was made whether there was anything in the file materials of Jefferson Savings and Loan that indicated any notice to the Wessons that they didn't get the insurance, and that matter they said that they cannot admit or deny because they don't know, but they did get deemed admitted that the yearly statements that they provided did not apprise the Wessons that there was no mortgage cancellation insurance. Now, we submit that that can never be relitigated again since it's been established, at least for purposes of this appeal. It's been established by a request being deemed admitted, which the court need not have done because it was 2 months between the time the requests were filed and the time that the answers were filed. We make no complaint about that. The court deemed it admitted anyway. But even if the court hadn't, a review of those closing statements at year end does not reflect anything that would put any party on notice. There are general code categories in those statements. A code category 11 meant insurance disbursements, and as I pointed out at the beginning, those disbursements were there every year but the first, and they fluctuated with time. There was nothing to put the Wessons on notice that there was a problem. Again, the people that controlled it was Jefferson, and they never sent anything to the Wessons apprising them. And that should be out of this case by now, and that contention not allowed, or at least not considered. But even if it were considered, in the most recent 11th hour filing of Jefferson Savings and Loan, they contend that an affidavit by a Ms. Vaughn supports the proposition that the Jeffersons were put on notice, but a review of that affidavit, and I know this is talking in a vacuum because I don't know if y'all have had an opportunity to see it, but a review of that affidavit will show that Ms. Vaughn never says that the Wessons got notice by letter or note or otherwise as to the reason for adjustments in their escrow account, and that is that there wasn't any mortgage cancellation insurance, but instead said they got a letter along with their closing statement that said your amount of installment payments is going to be reduced or increased. And then she says if they had any question, of course, they could call us, and then we'd tell them all about it. Well, there was no reason for anyone to call. There was no reason for them to do anything, for the Wessons to do anything, since they were paying the insurance premiums and they didn't control the amounts, and Jefferson just continued to collect them. The duty was owed, the duty was breached, and damages resulted from it. Every element, that is to say, there wasn't any insurance when Mr. Wesson passed away in 1976, and there wasn't anything that should have been there to discharge the indebtedness, therefore. The amount and the measure of damages was stipulated to. I would submit that every element of a cause of action has been established, and it's been established as a matter of law, and accordingly summary judgment was entirely proper. I believe that the best statement of the rule with regard to this type of transaction was written in Watkins versus Validity Fidelity Bank and Trust, Tennessee Court of Civil Appeals opinion. I've cited it in my brief, but if the court will indulge me. When a bank makes a charge against a borrower for credit life insurance premiums, includes that amount in the loan, and retains the money so charged, we hold the bank to the contractual obligation to properly apply the amount to credit life insurance, but also stands in a fiduciary capacity to the borrower to see that the amount so charged and withheld is actually applied to the purchase of such insurance. That, or at least tell the lessons, so that they can do something to protect themselves.
In
the
Massachusetts case, sir.
No, sir, that's a Tennessee case.
Tennessee.
I would also call the court's attention to a case, and I regret that I did not supply this in the brief, the case, a Mississippi Supreme Court case, which relies on the Watkins case, Parnell versus First Savings and Loan Association of Leakesville, 336.
I take it that will be in your reply to the reply for the citation.
Yes, sir, but it will be what I'd like to focus on.
Well, you're just giving us numbers now. We won't remember.
All right. In the Parnell case, the Watkins case was followed. That was a situation where there was a $13,000 loan to buy a house, and payments were made, first-year premium paid, and then periodic payments made. I go on with it, Your Honor, for this reason. The court there held that the act of collecting the premiums and retaining them assumed the contractual burden, replaced the bank then by doing so, assumed the contractual burden of getting it, and then it adopted the Watkins decision. In that case, the bank manager claimed that he noticed that the claimant had not signed an application. And if the court has had an opportunity to read Jefferson's brief, that is one of their contentions. Well, Mr. Wesson never signed an application, therefore he loses. Well, there it was contended that the man was put on notice that he had never signed an application. Signature of an application should not control the outcome of this suit where every element of the cause of action is established.
I take it that Parnell holds that the failure to buy the insurance discharges the debt.
Yes.
Because they failed to.
Discharges the remainder of the indebtedness. That's correct. What I found in reviewing the authorities touching upon this point is that the cases from jurisdiction to jurisdiction are not consistent in the way that they label this kind of cause of action. If you labeled it an affirmative form of estoppel or misrepresentation, whether it be innocent or not innocent, then each and every element of that cause of action is there. We have a closing statement, the form of which was prepared by Jefferson Savings and Loan, a closing statement which existed under which no amount for the initial payment was listed for credit life insurance, mortgage cancellation insurance, but it was included at the bottom of the page in the estimated monthly payment, and it was signed by Mr. and Mrs. Wesson. Now that is a statement, therefore, of fact. That is the $19.95 to be applied to mortgage cancellation insurance, intended to be relied upon, in fact relied upon, as supported by Ms. Wesson's affidavit, to the detriment of the plaintiff. I don't know how the court feels about estoppel as creating an affirmative cause of action in and of itself as opposed to being simply a defensive matter, but that label is not appropriate because it doesn't take into account the fiduciary duty, the strict duty owed by Jefferson to its depositor. Again, not a savings account, but an escrow account where Jefferson controlled the amount going in and the amounts going out. That category of cause of action doesn't take that into account. If we call it a contract or implied contract, that closing statement, offer by Jefferson Savings and Loan, signed by my client, and payments being made, good and valuable consideration, acceptance by my client, and a breach of that contract due to their failure to acquire it or undertake steps to acquire the insurance, again, a cause of action is established conclusively there. But again, that ignores the higher duty owed in the context of a depository relationship. Negligence certainly the conduct of Jefferson Savings and Loan, when we look to a negligence cause of action, cannot be that which would be excused. They control the account again. They had an identified $19.95, an identifiable through the payments, amount of money coming in for insurance, and they never told the Wessons that no insurance was obtained, but instead, on two adjustments, 2 years apart, had to adjust the escrow account because of the excess built up. That certainly constitutes negligence, and their failure to take any steps to acquire the insurance, whether to present an application to Mr. Wesson or to do whatever they can do under the law to do so, was the proximate cause of the damages. But again, their duty is not one of ordinary care. Their duty is one of a strict accountability to their depositors. Therefore, this case boils down to essentially two questions. And I guess it's true of any case. On whom should this loss fall? Well, in making that decision, our society has set up, and for rational bases, this relationship. The relationship of depositor to depository, which assures to Jefferson Savings and Loan that its collateral, the house, will not be subject to someone coming in forced sales or anything of that sort for failure to pay taxes or subject to loss for failure to pay insurance premiums. They enjoy the benefit of that. They have the money secure in their hand. They protect their collateral that way. It inures to the benefit of the Wessons because they are assured that they have the insurance, at least they thought they were. They're assured that their taxes were paid, and it's being controlled by an outfit that holds itself out to the public, at least, to be capable of doing these kinds of things. And yet, in this case, it was not done. Or should this loss fall upon the debtors, who had no reason at any time, no notice, remember it was deemed admitted, that there was any problem with their account. The only notice they had is that they were required by Jefferson Savings and Loan to pay $19.95 per month for mortgage cancellation insurance, which should have discharged this indebtedness to the benefit of the estate of Mr. Wesson and to the benefit of his widow, Mrs. Wesson, in the event of his death. I submit that it should fall upon the party who had control of the situation, Jefferson Savings and Loan, regardless of what label we put on it. Then what of this fact question that the Court of Civil Appeals raised? The fact question that the second opinion of the Court of Appeals raised was that there was whether Jefferson Savings and Loan could have acquired the insurance without the assistance of the Wessons. It's our position that that's no more relevant to this cause of action than whether or not an individual policy, had it been issued, would have contained policy defenses as against the Wessons. That cannot be a part of this type of cause of action, which is not a suit on an insurance policy, but instead is a suit for failure to procure insurance. To make a controlling fact question as to whether Jefferson could have acquired the insurance without the filling out of an application by the Wessons, to make that a fact question ignores all of the different possibilities of what could happen. It goes to the question of damages, which has been agreed to as to amount. What if no one would have issued insurance in a typical insurance agent relationship between the person who wants to get it? That's no defense there either. And the reason for that is because a person can make other dispensations, increase his group life insurance to make sure there's enough money in the till to pay it off in the case he dies, set aside more money and save it, make a different dispensation in his will. It goes to the question of damages, whether or not it really goes there, but it's no more relevant in that context than would be whether anybody would have issued the insurance. If it were a suit on an insurance policy, it may be a question whether he needed the assistance of the Wessons. But it's not. It's a suit for their failure to procure that insurance, and it's undisputed that they did. They failed to procure it. And that argument does not protect Jefferson for its failure to advise that no insurance was obtained, whether the Wessons could have acquired the insurance. Whether the Jefferson could have acquired it, with or without the assistance of the Wessons, has nothing to do with whether or not Jefferson owed a duty and breached it to advise that there was no insurance obtained, and there's nothing to indicate a single step done by the party controlling this transaction, the sophisticated lender, to make sure that an application was filled out if that such was necessary. They still had the duty to advise. And in this regard, I would like to point out one additional matter that was not included in my brief, and that is in the answers to requests for admissions. Jefferson Savings and Loan admits that in 1968, the year of this transaction, Jefferson Savings and Loan Association received a fee from the premium of mortgage cancellation insurance policies which it processed for its customers and which were accepted and written by the insurance company. That is admitted that in 1968, when one of the defendant's loan officers handled the loan on mortgage cancellation insurance was written through a company which the defendant represented, the officer would receive a fee from the premium of the insurance policy. That, too, is admitted. The point is, Jefferson could, at the very least, place that insurance. They did it. They got fees for it. And there's no excuse for them not doing it in this case, where they charged those premiums for all of those years. Thank you.
Mr. Counsel, the argument from the respondent.
May it please the court. I perceive that perhaps the court will realize before I get through that I'm talking about the same case that counsel is arguing. I'm sort of in a quandary as to where I should start. Should I controvert what he says, or should I support my motion for summary judgment? Maybe I will throw some in along on both. This court held in Republic Life Insurance Company against Hall, 232 Southwest 2nd, 697, that an insurance contract is no different from any other contract, and it's governed by the same principles of contract law. And further, that the application for the insurance signed by the applicant is the offer, and the acceptance of that and delivery of the policy is the acceptance. And I say that because it's important in this case, because there was never any application for insurance, and without it, there can be no insurance. That's what this court's holding was in the Hall case. But aside from that, the statute, Article 21.25 of the Insurance Code, specifically provides that every contract for insurance in this state shall be supported by an application with the questions asked and the answers given. There's nothing unusual or startling about those statements of the law. If one's going to get insurance, you just don't walk around in an empty room and get insurance. You've got to talk to somebody. You've got to give him your name, your address, the state of your health, and he's got to see that you're not on your last leg. At least you're still breathing.
Counsel, correct me if I'm wrong, but this is not a suit on an insurance policy. This is a suit for failure to obtain it.
We couldn't, unless he makes an application. That's our problem. He didn't make an application. And if he did make an application, they had to talk to somebody. Why isn't there something in this record attached to that motion for summary judgment saying that we talked to Mr. So-and-so and he said he would get it for us, or we paid Mr. So-and-so some money and he promised to arrange it? There's nothing like that in here.
Doesn't the record show they paid your company $19.95?
That's what counsel says. But attached to our reply, our application for writ at page 18, we reduced the size of the settlement sheet at the title company to page size, and there you will see that there was a spot for mortgage insurance monthly payments, and it said Brian, and it adds up the figures and they all come to $830. Now, the settlement sheet at the title company in disbursing the funds put up by the contractor and Jefferson put up to fund it and to put up by the purchaser of the home. Totals it all up. And he made the statement that Jefferson prepared all the papers. We'll just look on that statement in there. Not that statement, but in the record. I think it's page 253 in the transcript, but I'm not sure and don't depend on. But in the transcript affixed to our motion for summary judgment, we show the complete, and $115 is paid to B.E. Wharton by them for preparation of the papers and handling the closing of it. We didn't pay B.E. Wharton one dime. And then it says, estimated taxes. Now, after the settlement sheets are all fixed up here, in the middle of the page, in capital letters, estimated monthly payment for taxes. And they give the state and the city and the county, etc. And then below that it says, estimated monthly payments. Principal and interest, $148.43 a month. Taxes, $22.63 a month. Fire and extended coverage insurance, I'll just call it fire insurance, $15 a month. Mortgage cancellation insurance, $19.95. But not one dime was paid that day on mortgage cancellation insurance. That was a monthly payment to be paid in the future. Council states that we had the money to pay it with. Well, you just take the $19.95 and multiply it by 12 and you get $239.40. But there wasn't but 11 monthly payments in that first 12 months because you didn't pay that month that he closed it out on March the 1st, 1968. So there wasn't but 11 months in there. He didn't furnish mortgage cancellation insurance. But let's drop back a little bit first. Wesson came in, and Ms. Wesson too, to make application for a loan. And they say this sophisticated insurance company and these poor little people. Well, he ain't got no more sympathy for the maimed, the halt, the blind, and the non-compass minister than I, because I represent
Mr. Street. I suggest that you stay behind the rostrum and speak into the mic for the reasons that I mentioned first.
All right.
Thank you.
I hope the court has heard what I've said. But this sophisticated borrower owned apartments. It'll be shown on the application. So on six lots in one addition and six more lots in another addition. And he's built a house on this particular lot on which the loan is being made. He is not so unsophisticated as one would suggest. But he was 50 years old, too, in the application shows. Being 50 years old, he got a 25-year loan, so the last payment would be made on his 75th birthday. Now, there ain't anything wrong with being 75 years old if you can make it. In another week, I'll make 77, so that's fine. He's not so old after all. But insurance people don't write insurance on people 50 years of age for mortgage cancellation insurance unless it's for life insurance. You can't get credit life insurance, but for less than 5 years, that's the law. Now, I'll just diverge a minute and point out that in his reply to I application for writ, and that's one reason why I didn't get in my reply to that until last week, until I got to reviewing it, I see that he said that we could have gotten the insurance, Jefferson Savings. We might have written him some credit life for less than 5 years. But he says that we were duty bound under Insurance Code Article 3.538C to obtain this insurance. And that section of the statute is credit life insurance. And the first paragraph, the second paragraph of that statute specifically says, it shall not be for a term longer, not for a term less than 5 years. That didn't even say 5 years. shall be for a term less than 5 years. When you write the credit life, you call it writing it for 59 months because you've got to follow the statute and write it for less than 5 years. And that's all. And anybody can get a license to write the credit life insurance if you're going to write that kind of insurance. But this was a 25-year loan. Furthermore, that statute, Section 6D of it, Big D, provides that there's got to be an application. And there was no application. So we couldn't possibly, nobody could have possibly written Wesson's a 25-year loan under that statute. That's Article 3.538C. Then he cites Article 3.50 of the Insurance Code and says, we could have procured it under that section of the statute. Well, that's the industrial life and insurance section of the statute. And it specifically says that is limited to $20,000, and this was a $21,000 loan, and that it can be...
Is there any evidence to show where the 1995 figure came from, who computed it?
No, they didn't produce any proof, and we didn't know who it was. It's not in the record of my investigation trying to find out if this lady was halfway entitled to this money, I'd have said, hey, that's all there is to that.
In the beginning, did you collect $206 a month from these people as this estimated monthly payment shows?
No. We collected it April the 1st. This was closed March the 1st, so we didn't have the money.
From the time the first payments were paid to your company, were they $206 a month?
They were a little less. That was the estimated. Later on, we reduced it down $10 on one occasion, and later on, we reduced it down $9. And later on, we raised it back up. And
before
the reason
the
for
the reductions, how much were the payments?
$206.
And that included $19.95 for mortgage cancellation insurance.
Yes. But they didn't make any monthly payment for the first month of insurance.
Now, mortgage cancellation insurance ordinarily is a reducing term.
Yes.
Policy, isn't it?
That's a lifetime policy.
Right.
Yeah, you can't get credit life for more than 6 years, 59 months. Now this 3.50 of the statute that he says on page 12 of his reply to our application, we could have gotten it under that. Well, that is specifically for employers with at least 50 employees. And you can't borrow but $20,000 under it unless you end up going to do some horticultural work or farming work, and then you can borrow up to $50,000 if you don't borrow it for longer than 1 year. So there was no way for anybody to write him any insurance under that section of the statute. This shows you how desperate they are to try to create a cause of action. Then in the last desperate straw effort, he says we could have written it or had it written under Article 5069, 3.18 of the code. That's on regulated loans. Now, how in the world he ever got to that statute, it's difficult to understand, because that statute says regulated loans, and the maximum amount that you can borrow under it is $2,500, it so states in the statute. The first $300, you can charge $18 a hundred, and after $300, you charge 8% for all up to $2,500. This was a $21,000 loan. So he's citing the court statutes that have no application whatsoever. Nobody could have gotten him insurance under those statutes or those articles. But the thing that perhaps really forced me to file what he calls a late reply was when I read his brief at page 7, at his reply. I believe it was application for writ, page 7. And I read that thing, and he purported to quote from the Pippin case. 229, I believe. That's in material, the Pippin case, it's all over here. And he quotes from page 241 of the Pippin case in the Court of Civil Appeals. That's 432nd, I know. And he starts from head note 4. It's the bottom of the left-hand side of page 241. And there are three lines there. And then it goes up here, the right-hand side, I can see it now. And there are three lines up there. And then he picks up the word had and quotes out the rest of that sentence, which ends with the word success. And then he has dot, 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 three of them. And then he picks up with the, a little t, T-H-E. And quotes from head note 9, page 242. And puts that conglomeration of opinion, excerpts from the opinion together, to try to formulate a concept on which you can base a judgment in Wesson's favor. And it took me some time to figure that out, but I finally figured it out. It's three lines out of head note 4, and the first line out of head note 9, and they're put together with no distinguishing marks. The only thing that finally allowed me to put it together was I looked down at the reference, trying to figure out where it was. He says 241 and 242. And so I read each one, and looking for the lines over here out of his quote, and I found the three lines in head note 4 and the first line of head note 9. Now I wasn't taught to present cases like that. I believe I would have stopped and put quotation marks and said, then the court further said in paragraph so-and-so this. At least let the court know what we were talking about. So when I saw that, I thought I ought to call it to the court's attention, especially with his citation of cases, I mean statutes that have nothing to do with this lawsuit, and nobody could have written him insurance under.
Counsel, the thing that disturbed some of us on the application for writ of error, and I may have the facts wrong, if I do, I'm sure you'll correct me, that the loan commitment was subject to mortgage cancellation insurance required.
Yes.
You required.
Yes, sir.
You required them to buy insurance, which you say you could not have bought and they could not have bought.
Oh, yes. They could have bought life insurance.
Mortgage cancellation insurance required.
Well, they could have bought life insurance, a term, some kind, well, don't you see? But you can't buy it under the credit life. You can't buy it under the industrial life.
Counsel, we assume this is not this old sophisticated banker that you're talking about that you're lending money to, but the nice old traditional lady in tennis shoes.
All right.
And you say you got to have cancellation insurance before we'll make you this loan.
That's right.
And you go to the closing and they start taking out 1995 for insurance and do that over a period of time. They might say, well, this nice insurance savings loan would not require something that couldn't be done. They must be justified in taking out this money. So we'll pay it.
He could have bought life insurance, I guess.
He could have bought it, so could you.
If he could, no, I can't buy life insurance on your life.
We told him, counsel, that you were acquiring it and you took the money out. That's our problem.
Wait, we required it. First is he asked for a loan of $23,800. You'll notice that on the application, it's in the transcript. No, $21,800. And then on the upper right-hand corner, it's written in ink. This is so long ago, I couldn't find anybody who remembered the thing. It's written up there, wants to increase to $23,800. And the thing in there, we issued him a commitment of $23,800. And the next instrument is a letter saying we require a $2,800 pledge. I don't know whether the court is sufficiently familiar with that, but ordinarily, the contractor will put up a pledge where the man doesn't have enough security and he has some question like that. You can put up a pledge. Well, and then we required mortgage cancellation insurance. Apparently, they had some problem about putting up the pledge for $2,800. And then apparently, he couldn't get the mortgage cancellation insurance because you couldn't write the kind they're talking about. You had to have life insurance. And very likely, people turned him down. I don't want to just make some nasty statements. Anybody can do that if you've got a mean enough heart. But I think they went to try to get that insurance, and they couldn't get it. He was 50 years old. It had to be for 25 years, and that's longer than a 50-year-old man's life expectancy. And I think he couldn't get it. So what did they do? He came back and said, forget the $23,800. I'll just pay you $2,800 more. And that's what he did, and that's what the loan was finally for, $21,000, after having paid $2,800 down more, which gave him a bigger equity, which would justify his loan. I think that's what happened. I don't know why they didn't come up with some information if they talked to anybody about it, but they're bound to have done so, because we all lending institutions at one time or another make a requirement for life insurance. Nothing unusual about it at all. That's take a person of high earnings and not so much security. His ability to pay is going to depend upon his continued existence. If he fails to continue to exist, you want the life insurance to reduce the loan down to something that's possible to be paid off by the heirs. So it's nothing unusual. He couldn't get it, I don't think. And that's why he paid an additional $2,800 down. And I think the person's handling it said, well, if you pay $2,800 down, goodness knows, we'll pass you. You'll have plenty of equity for the loan. I think that's what the situation was. But I have no proof on it. I'm just going by the circumstances. There was an application for $21,800 loan. And then there was a notation about he wants it raised to $23,800. And then a commitment was issued for $23,800 with a pledge of $2,800 required. And then it finally closes out with a $21,000 loan. So he reduced it $2,800 and got a $21,000 loan. That's my conclusion from these facts, and I think both parties have exhausted the search on those. And if they did go talk to anybody about insurance, they haven't made any affidavit in the record regarding it. But aside from those facts, we feel that they haven't shown any duty or obligation. Now, bear in mind, Jefferson could not, nor could anybody else, have written any insurance except life insurance. And Jefferson couldn't write life. In order to write life insurance, you've got to swear that you 50% of your time is spent just writing life insurance and you're an independent business. Now, you can write this credit life. Anybody on the bench, or me, or anybody out here can sign a little application and get a permit to write credit life. Take no test or anything else. But when you get into that real insurance, going for a lifetime, you've got to have a license, you've got to take a course, you've got to study it and all that sort of stuff.
Counsel, this is a summary judgment case, but does the record show who placed the hazard insurance?
That's interesting. It's a very fine question. I appreciate it. I might have overlooked it, I don't think, but I appreciate it. You know, when we gave him that commitment, we said, this loan will be funded when you produce. Let us know when you have these. We sent it to the Orange County Abstract and Title Company, and give us a deed of trust, a note, a survey, a title policy. We've got a first and superior lien on the property, a survey after the improvements are complete showing that the improvements are located on the particular lot on which we have a lien, copy of deed restrictions, etc., etc., and typed in mortgage cancellation insurance required. But among the things listed was fire and extended coverage insurance. Of course, if you're going to take a land on a piece of property, you want fire and extended coverage insurance, and it was there. And when they closed the loan, he came up with every instrument that was required, except mortgage cancellation. He came up with the fire insurance with a full year's premium paid. I see my time is about out. I want to call the court's attention right quickly if I can. He failed to come up with a mortgage cancellation insurance policy. He failed to pay the first month's premium. We had no money to pay it for the insurance if we could have written it or could have talked anybody into writing it. So there was at least the first month when he had no money. Then attached to our motion for summary judgment, we had the affidavit of Nona Vaughn, the escrow clerk, who swears that she was there all during that period of time, that the exhibits F1, 2, 3, 4 through 9 are true and correct exhibits of their account, and those exhibits show the annual statement. The annual statement shows the date, the amount of money paid, and the code number for what it is. It's 11 on Jefferson. You look down, it says insurance. And those annual statements will show anybody who looks at them that there never was any enough money expended just for mortgage cancellation insurance. Never was. Now, there was money expended for insurance for fire and extended coverage, if they had looked at it. But Nona Vaughn also said in that affidavit that every time the payments were changed, when we reduced it $10 because it had been accumulation of funds, there's nothing unusual for people to overpay their escrow account. They know their taxes are going up and their insurance is going up. So when there was an accumulation, we reduced their payment. On another occasion, we reduced it. First occasion, $10. Next time, $9. And then we went back up with it because the funds we used up. And she said, every time, it was an invariable practice. I know, I did it myself, that we sent out a letter explaining why the reduction. Somebody, if you owe the bank a note for so much a month and they write you and say, we're reducing your note, you say, Lord, ain't that a great bank? You'll read the letter, and the letter told them why they were reducing it. And then if they had examined their statement, they could have seen that there wasn't any money there to pay mortgage cancellation insurance because only money was for fire and extended coverage. There never was an expenditure big enough to carry both, and there never was an expenditure big enough to carry even mortgage cancellation at $19.95 a month. And bear in mind, the first 12 months, there wasn't but 11 payments. Now, we cite the bank, case of Weinstein Bank, Weinstein against National Bank of Jefferson, for the proposition that they are stopped. In that case, Weinstein came to the bank some 6 months later and says, listen here, these checks you paid, that's a forgery. Back then in January, you paid a check there, that's a forgery. And these two in February, those are forgeries. And the bank says, my goodness, why didn't you tell us about it? And Chief Justice Gaines, speaking for the court in Weinstein against the bank, in 6 original Southwest 171 in 1887, says he is stopped. He should have examined his statement. Shouldn't we all? Should have examined his statement. And the bank wouldn't have paid those other forgeries if he'd just told them about that first one in January. And we say that's applicable today in this case as it was in Weinstein's case. Then I want to point out that when Wesson failed to produce the policy and failed to pay the first month of premium, they breached the contract, and this court held in Gulf Pipeline against 128 Second 1065 that it is elementary that one who breaches a contract cannot maintain an action on it. And this court also held.
Counsel, if they breached the contract, why did the company accept the payments for premiums in subsequent months thereafter?
Well, that could, you know, you can send the bank any amount of money you want to send.
Well, I'm sure they'll take it.
They send a check for $206 a month to take care of their taxes and insurance. And then at the end of the year, it wasn't enough to absorb it all, so it built up. When it built up, they reduced the payments. And then built up some more, they reduced the payments.
Did they ever tell them that they didn't have credit insurance?
No, because I think actually they waived it when you put down $2,800 more. There was no occasion to tell him, but they did explain by letter 3 times, the lady says, and that's not controversial. They don't deny it.
Are you saying that when he paid the $2,800 you keep referring to, that you then removed your requirement that the man had mortgage cancellation?
I'm saying that's the basis upon which this loan was closed, because they gave him first a commitment for $23,800 and they later closed it for $21,800.
And you're saying
$21,000 even.
Your company your savings and loan, communicated that information to the man, saying, now you don't have to have mortgage cancellation insurance. So now we're not going to charge you the $19.95.
Well, I can't say that that was done, because I have no proof of it. All I can go by is the circumstances.
It's not shown in the record, is it?
Not shown in the record, except the circumstances that he asked for $23.8 for a loan, and then we said you'd have to put up a $2,800 pledge, and then we reduced our commitment to $21,000. And he paid $2,800 more down, and the loan was closed at $21,000. And we say that they can't maintain an action on a contract which they haven't complied with. They breached it by failing to make the payment for the 1995, the first month. We didn't have the money for the first month. And next is he didn't have an application. And next is he's a stop. Thank you very much, Your Honor. I see my time is up.
Thank you, counsel. Your rebuttal argument on petition.
Several points of clarification. First of all, Mr. Adams indicated that the savings and loan, that there wasn't any proof that the 1995 was with reference to mortgage cancellation insurance. Page 36 of the record, answers to interrogatories filed signed by the president under oath of the savings and loan, said an inspection of the closing statement dated March 1, 1968 indicates that the computation of the monthly payment did include a monthly mortgage cancellation insurance premium of $19.95. It's out of the mouth of the president of the company that point is established. He goes on to state that an examination of the ledger sheet indicates an escrow amount of $57.57, of which $19.95 was apparently included as a monthly premium for mortgage cancellation insurance. It was out of the mouth of the savings and loan at that point was established.
Well,
Mr.
Answer part of this question, I think, because it's kind of gotten down to this one point. They took the money, no question about that, the 1995.
That's right.
And there's no question but what that was for, mortgage cancellation insurance.
That's right.
But now, how could the savings and loan have acquired the mortgage cancellation insurance without your man having made an application for it?
I don't believe they could have. I acquired it. But again, it's not a suit on an insurance policy. It's on a suit that they said that they would acquire it and charge money for it.
Okay, they required the insurance.
All right,
then they collected this insurance along with the fire and extended coverage insurance.
Yes, sir.
Every year, under the typical situation, the insurance company will then send the annually a bill or a statement to the insurance company, to the savings and loan, for the amount of each of those premiums. And then from the escrow money, the savings and loan will then pay the annual premium on that policy. Could it not be that your client was in default for not obtaining the policy itself? All they were doing was saying, we'll escrow this amount of money for you so that annually we can pay your premium.
If that was all they were saying, maybe so. But that is not all they were saying. What they said is that mortgage cancellation insurance is required, did not say who was to acquire it. And in terms of the record in this case, what we have is we don't know who got that fire and extended. I suspect my suspicions are the same as yours, Your Honor. But they created the burden to acquire the insurance when they charged for it, or if indeed they couldn't get it under the law, or if indeed they couldn't get it in the requisite amount under the law, then you don't keep on charging the money. You go back to the borrower and you say, listen, we've been charging you $19.95 month after month after month. We haven't gotten the insurance, and here's why. Sign this blank. We know that they had blanks to sign. Now, the savings and loan isn't an insurance company, but we know they had blanks to sign for mortgage cancellation insurance because I read to the court the answers to requests for admissions, which admitted that they even got a fee from the insurance companies for it.
In this case?
No, not in this case, because they didn't buy the insurance. This is where they made these loans. They got a fee for it. Now, counsel is correct with reference to the statutes. cited in brief what I did, and I promised myself I wouldn't do it, is I rose to the bait of going off on what I conceived as a rabbit trail, and that is not the question of whether or not they could have bought the insurance. That cannot be a question in this case, because it isn't a suit on an insurance, it's a promise to procure it, or a duty, a fiduciary duty, to advise that it was not or that they could not procure it.
Counselor,
to do something.
Before we get off that, let's get back to this. Now, this is a summary judgment proceeding.
Yes, sir.
And you say there's nothing whatever in the record to show who had the burden of securing an insurance policy.
In the closing instructions. But the burden is established as to who was to acquire it, or at least undertake steps to acquire it, by the closing statement. The closing statement, which was prepared, deemed admitted by an order on the transcript, page 313, order deeming admitted the following, that the closing statement, which is attached here too, with the figures penciled in on it, is contained in the files of Jefferson Savings Bank, and was prepared by an officer or an employee of the defendant. Now, it is signed by the closing agent, as you might expect.
Okay, where on that does it say who is responsible for getting the insurance policy?
It does not. It does not say Jefferson
Savings.
Okay,
and that, yes, wouldn't that be an essential part of some judgment proceeding? If you're saying their duty was to get it and we paid them, they should get it, where is the proof for summary judgment purposes?
For summary judgment purposes, the proof is that they, on their form, in their amount, did not require it in the original payment, but required it in the monthly payment, mortgage cancellation insurance, signed and agreed to.
Well, we're talking about securing the policy, not making the payment. Where is any proof as to who is supposed to get that policy issued?
There is no writing anywhere saying Jefferson is supposed to get the policy or my client. There is the conduct of the parties, which is undisputed, and that is that Jefferson controlled the transaction, prepared this form, and said on this form that the undersigned authorizes and ratifies the disbursements of the funds as stated herein. This could constitute a contract were we to label this cause of action a suit of on a contract. This is an offer, and the signature and the payment of the money was accepted for valuable consideration. There is the contract to procure the insurance. However, our point is that that is not the cause of action here. The cause of action here arises out of not necessarily a contract, but a fiduciary duty to either get the insurance or undertake steps to get it, or to tell the Westons that it was not or could not be obtained.
Why couldn't it be just as logically argued that that requirement, mortgage cancellation insurance, is required, is putting the burden on them to get it, is on the association to get it? I'm having
why that individual statement?
A summary judgment proof as to who was to get the insurance, and looks to me like that's the turning point of the case.
The summary judgment proof as to who was to get the insurance is established in the conduct of the party.
Is it correct, and does the record show that your client obtained the fire and extended coverage policy himself?
Your Honor, I didn't see that in the record. So I don't know that the summary judgment facts show that at all. But again, that wouldn't control the outcome of the case. Nor would the question of who was to get the insurance control the outcome of the case. Because the duty was not simply to get the insurance. If we bought hook, line, and sinker, every argument of Mr. Adams, whatever the speculation, he was too old to get the insurance. That's not in the record either. But if we bought that hook, line, and sinker, we do know this, undisputed, unrefuted, they were in the business of making these loans. They were in the business of controlling this escrow account. They collected premiums for it. By affidavit, our people thought that premium bought mortgage cancellation insurance. They, at the very least, owed a duty to apprise that none was obtained or they couldn't get it, and they didn't do that. If they owed simply the duty of getting it, you're right, Your Honor. That would be it.
Well,
I didn't have the summary judgment proof. I'll prove it in court at trial. But they owed the duty to tell us that it wasn't, and they never did at any point.
But you have admitted that they couldn't do it.
No, sir. I have admitted that I don't think they could have done it.
The statute don't apply to it. Now the statute would permit.
No, Your Honor. That's not. I didn't get all that out. What it is this. I don't believe that under the statute, the savings and loan could write a policy on their own group coverage, okay, to cover this particular loan. Mr. Adams is incorrect in his characterization of my arguments under the statute. There are limitations under the insurance code and under regulated loans as to amounts, duration of loans, and things of that sort. I brought those up to point out that Jefferson's contention that it couldn't get any insurance at all was not true. But it does not say that Jefferson cannot get the insurance. Jefferson admitted under this record, and those matters admitted under the request for admissions, I think, establish it, that they place the insurance and receive a fee, and their individual officer receives a fee for placing insurance. Now, that these statutes mean that Jefferson's group coverage on its lenders can't cover this loan. But it doesn't mean that Jefferson can't go out and get it. But I don't believe they could have gotten it without an application. There's no application in this.
Has a physical been required?
I beg your pardon?
Is anything in the record to show whether a physical is required?
No, sir.
For this type of insurance?
Nothing in the record to show a physical is required.
Would you have to show that he was insurable for damages on their failure to advise you that they hadn't gotten that policy?
No, sir.
In other words, that you could have gotten it yourself?
No, sir. Any more than we would have to establish conclusively that an insurance company would have issued the insurance. In a case such as this, when a man died 6 years ago, when the original transaction occurred 10 years ago, how would we ever make such a
time of loan? I don't know where a physical is required or not, but ordinary life, I do know a physical is required.
Well, and it may have been.
I just wondered if you would have to show that he was insurable to show damages.
No, sir. Our position is that we would not have to show him to be insurable or that any insurance company would have insured him because, as I pointed out in my opening statement, that goes to the reliance question. There are any number of things that a borrower who is led to believe that he's got mortgage cancellation insurance can do if he were ever apprised that they didn't get it. He can make a different dispensation in his will. He can make an increase in his group life policy maybe. He could maybe not buy that Buick in the last 10 years of his life. There's any number of things that show his loss in reliance. And if anything happens, it has to be presumed. Because how else out of the mouth of a dead man am I ever going to prove any of those items? The wrong is committed. The insurance wasn't obtained, and the parties were led to believe that it was. Whether or not they could have actually bought it, they went about controlling this transaction and leading them to believe that they could have bought it.
What did the bank do with the $19 per month?
What they ultimately did with it, Your Honor, and I can't give you the exact transcript reference, what they ultimately did is they reduced the next year's payment by $10, and then they took the accumulated excess, and I believe if I'm correct, applied it to the principal of the note. The escrow agent, wearing the hat of an escrow agent, they went over...
They didn't go south with it.
No, they didn't go south with it. As I admitted at the start, the Wessons, you know, they didn't take the money.
I remember as an assistant attorney general, we had a firm from Louisiana. We had an office over here near the Capitol, and every time you signed a note, there were 6 carbons. And without ever knowing it, you bought life insurance, health insurance, accident insurance, dog insurance, and they charged you for all that, and therefore it was not usurious because you bought all that insurance.
I don't even know if it would amount to usury in terms of the amounts of money, Your Honor. I would point out, with reference to what Mr. Adams stated, that the closing instructions for conventional loans were promulgated by Jefferson County Savings and Loan Association, and those instructions were sent to Orange County Title Company, not to the Wessons. And there is nothing stated in here requiring that the Wessons provide any of these items. Frankly, I wasn't there. And at that particular point in my life, I couldn't even tell you what all the details and nuances of these transactions were, nor could I tell you now. But I do know that the Wessons didn't prepare the deed of trust and all of those other items, and the Wessons didn't prepare the earnest money contract. And to contend that the Wessons were the ones that were supposed to come up with all of these individual items under this closing instruction prepared by that savings and loan, I don't think is supported. Finally, the Weinstein case points out where exactly we are. That's a guy that had a checking account in a bank, and just as a technicality, the justice in that court did not say that he was a stop.
As a matter of fact, he said that the plea of estoppel failed because the bank couldn't show any harm to itself. But they did say that an instruction to the jury was proper with regard to it, that the neglect on the part of the person holding the checking account could be considered, could bar him. But that's a man that controls the deposits that go in and the amounts that come out. Here, the escrow agent controlled the amount that came in and controlled the amount that came out, not the Westons, except to the extent of paying what they were ordered to pay.
At what point in the life of this note did they first adjust the escrow balance to take the excess and apply it back to the principal reduction?
I believe it was almost a year after. It was 11. I can't give you the exact date. After the loan was closed and payments began to be made, then at the first closing, then it was adjusted down $10. And I believe it was exactly a year later. I may be incorrect, but something like that. But it was adjusted down $9 more, and then I think 2 or 3 years elapsed, and they went back up in those adjustments.
Coincidentally, that first adjustment was made when the first annual premium would have been paid by the association to the company had there been insurance.
Precisely. And yet nothing was sent. Mr. Adams, if just a moment, Mr. Adams referred to the Nona Vaughn affidavit. I would merely request that the court read that, and the court will find that, unlike Mr. Adams stated, the note that they send does not tell the reason for the adjustment. The note that she contends that they say just tells them that adjustment is being made and not the reason for it. And again, that matter was deemed admitted at the trial. Thank you for your time. I appreciate your questions.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted on written briefs and oral arguments from both parties. The court will take a brief recess.
The audience will withdraw.